Welcome to the Punch and Judy Show. This is your host, Judy Berry. Well, today, I'm, as usual, everything just jam-packs. Every time I try to set up one of these shows, they always end up too full. So, as usual, the show's going to be too full today. There's a lot of stuff going on, and we're going to start with local updates from some of the different struggles that are taking place. We're going to have a report live from the Headwaters trial of the 1,033 defendants. Actually, there's seven of them being tried kind of as representative trials, so it's seven 1,033ths of the people. So anyway, we're going to have a live report of what's going on in that courtroom is how we're going to start. We're going to have a report in on the Caltrans spraying. We're going to have a second live report from the Headwaters Walkers, who are going to be having a rally. Actually, it should be starting right about now in Ukiah. We'll get a call in from that. We're going to be talking to Renee Gannon from SNAG about the RETEC struggle. And then we got something really special at the end. I wanted to, like, have somebody come on this show and just give a little update on Geronimo Pratt's trial, because a lot's going on in it, and there's actually a good chance he may get a new trial. And when I tried to find somebody who would speak for the defense, the person I ended up getting was Geronimo Pratt's brother. So I decided if we get Geronimo Pratt's brother, we're going to give him more than a 10-minute update. So the last half hour of this show, I'm really actually honored to be able to interview Geronimo Pratt's brother about, of course, Geronimo Pratt being the Black Panther who's still in jail 25 years later after COINTELPRO. So anyway, that's kind of what the show is in a nutshell. And if you can squeeze in calls on other subjects around that, then I wish you luck. And in the meantime, let me go right away to the first report. Okay, so Naomi?
Hi, Judy.
Okay.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I think we got you now.
Okay, I'm at a phone booth in Fortuna.
Okay, and this is Naomi Wagner, and she's reporting on the Headwaters trials. Go ahead.
And it's really been fascinating and very funny at times in the courtroom here. It's a very quaint little courtroom. The judge's name is Anatoly Banducci.
Oh, he was the judge last time. He was a kick.
Yeah, and he seems to be in a very good mood and to be very receptive to hearing the pretty extended comments and statements of the witnesses who are also the defendants. But just to back up, there are seven defendants, as you mentioned, and they're a pretty star-studded crowd. Among them, Cecilia Landman, Tracy Cattleman, Jane Lapiner from the Matole, Naomi Steinberg, the rabbi for Redwoods from Carlotta, and Robert Woods Sutherland. I left out a couple, Peter Childs and Paula Berkeley.
I like that kind of star set. No Woody Harrelsons, though, huh?
No, but we're definitely holding our own here. And so each of them, well, they started out interviewing the sheriffs and the arresting officers to kind of corroborate what, you know, took place on September 15th in stepping across the green line and committing nonviolent civil disobedience. And so the three basic parts of the things that are being asserted here, you know the legal terms for this, Ginny,
I think it's argument.
Arguments on behalf of the defendants are that they were committing symbolic free speech under the First Amendment, that they have a right to equal protection under the law, that's the 14th Amendment, and not to be selectively prosecuted, and that they are presenting a defense of necessity, in other words, that they committed a smaller crime in order to prevent a greater one from occurring, that crime being the destruction of Headwaters Forest by Charles Hurwitz. So after they interviewed the sheriffs and Arcata police who arrested the defendants, they kind of established the basic parameters, but there were some very funny things that came out of that, because the officers had to describe how totally overwhelmed they were, how they had never seen this many arrestees in one place. It was said over and over that this was the biggest environmental protest in the U.S. One officer cited his experience at Concord and on the UC campuses during peak riot times, and he said he'd never seen this big, massive of a crowd so willing and intent on being arrested and yet so nonviolent and cooperative. So we got a lot of compliments here.
All right, aren't we great?
And then one of the first witnesses for the defense was the defendant, Naomi Steinberg, and she was awesome. Her little editorial here, her particular motive was her religious convictions and her the obligation, a moral obligation, she felt as a, as she says, a student rabbi. She was a rabbi in training. And there's a requirement in Jewish law that we confront others who, people in co-religionists, as she put it, who violate Jewish law. And she says that she's done this, she's confronted and contacted Charles Hurwitz personally and through the rabbis for Redwoods and through her Rabbi Schoenberg, and they've all made the statement to Charles Hurwitz and, that he is violating Jewish moral law. And she felt that she needed to then go a step further and step over the green line to follow through on her moral obligation. So the other defendants said similar things, but I think that she had the strongest religious conviction that she was compelled to do this. Cecilia Landman, of course, showed in detail how she has exhausted the administrative process. I don't think anyone can compare with her efforts to do that, from the 14 lawsuits to the presentations of the Board of Forestry and her presentations in Washington, D.C. to subcommittees in Congress on the need to enforce the Endangered Species Act. And she was, as usual, eloquent in showing how the agencies, the resource management agencies, failed so utterly to do so. And so she was establishing the need for civil disobedience because of the failure of the agencies to protect the resources and uphold the law.
Okay, so hold on a minute.
I could go on.
No,
and on.
Wait, no, you can't. You can't go on because the show is
cut.
Yes. Okay. Boy, it's hard to get a question in with you. Naomi, you're as aggressive as I am.
I'm Jewish, too.
Half Italian. Anyway, so, well, first of all, you mentioned equal protection. And I'm presuming that when you say that they're complaining about not equal protection, this refers to the fact that the last 150 people over the line were not arrested.
Right. And I think it's actually more like 200 or more. And the attorney, Jay Moeller, the defense attorney, has been questioning the prosecution witnesses and the cops a lot on the subject of how they performed the arrests, whether there were discrepancies in how they treated certain people. Tracy Cattleman and Woods said that their handcuffs were put on very tight, and the judge did not strike that when there was a motion to overrule that testimony. And also the 200 people at the very end who basically were not allowed to be arrested. They were allowed to step over the green line, but then they were just kind of allowed to go back again because the cops had run out of handcuffs and citations and no longer had pencils and paper to write on.
And that and now that's a, really, so which is great.
And there was testimony just before I left from a peacekeeper who said that he was waiting with the last group of potential arrestees, and that the cops said to him, "Hey, we're just tired, we're exhausted, we're out of everything, and if you just go home, we'll go home if you'll go home."
Little did they know we were busy blockading the other gates for the next day.
They were ready for the next wave.
Okay, so hold on a minute. So what I want to say to any of the 1,030...
The unequal protection is that they treated a large group of arrestees in a substantially different way.
Right, and also that's also one of the arguments for saying that this is symbolic free speech and not actually a trespass because some of the people were not even arrested. But what I want to just address the 1,033 arrestees right now because, and of course, I'm sure every one of them is listening, with our Skip satellite. But anyway, that I understand there's a letter being prepared right now to mail out to everybody. So if people feel that they're lacking information, hold on, information will be coming in the mail. But what I want to say is that this strategy, this was sent out in an earlier letter, but if people aren't, you know, realizing exactly what's going on, I just want to clarify it. That the decision was made in the strategy for the defense that these token trials or whatever would be put on first, and if they win, if they declare them not guilty based on those arguments, then whatever that will also be applied to the other 1,033. So if these seven win,
there's another little matter of the green line itself, and that is it seems very questionable whether that actually represented a property line of PLs or not. And the only all the officers who testified, with one exception, said that they were just told by either their superior officer or by John Campbell that that was the line. and no one seemed to really know, quote, who did it. You know,
right.
It was whether the protesters snuck in there at night and painted it, or if John Campbell's guys painted it. Nobody really seemed to know. The only officer who seemed to have an idea, a definite opinion about that was Officer Jimenez, who's somewhat famous, or infamous, I might say, for his use of force in the arrest. He claimed to know that it was the property line and that it somehow conformed to a real surveyed line, but it was really hearsay testimony.
Okay, well, anyway, what I wanted to say to the arrestees, though, is that, if this trial is won, if the seven people win, then the dismissal will be applied to all of the arrestees. If, however, they lose, and by losing, that can even just mean guilty but no fine, if anything other than a dismissal comes out of this case, then they're going to appeal it. Then and all of the other cases will be stayed until after the appeal. So I just want people to be aware of that. That's what people, you're not falling through the cracks. You know, it's not being ignored. But anyway, just hold on and you'll get a letter in the mail and hopefully that'll explain anything. Well, you know what, Naomi? We're actually out of the allotted time for this, but we're not out of the subject matter. So I want you to, I want you to answer something really quick, okay?
What?
Because you've also been involved in the other trials of the direct action people, of the 250 or so that were arrested after September 15th. For blockading things and chaining themselves to things. And can you just give us a real quick capsule of how those are going?
Well, it's hard to give a quick overview on these because they're so numerous, and there's a lot more diversity in what people did, where they were arrested, how their circumstances of their arrest, and how they behaved in jail and how they were treated. One of the biggest differences I see also is that the Fortuna Court is a very citizen-friendly type of place, whereas the Eureka Court is a very intimidating, unfriendly place, and the judges are much more serious, and they seem to think that, you know, there's some kind of qualitative difference in the protesters themselves, which is, of course, a political, opinion, but, you know, that this somehow means that stepping over the line in on Fisher Road was different than stepping over the line or blockading on some other road or in the forest. And they really do seem to treat people a lot differently depending on how they're dressed, how they appear, and just their prejudiced attitudes.
Okay, and then, but one thing, though, is it does seem that these trials are somewhat overwhelming. The court, you gave me a statistic of how many?
Well, there's supposed to be a meeting at 3 o'clock this afternoon, which was ordered by Judge Morrison yesterday, to take place between the public defender's office and the district attorney to, quote, get real about the trials that are pending. Because this is just, I don't think they've even quantified the expanse of actual trials. They're still hung up on the scheduling of the trials, which is almost impossible because there's so much crossover between defendants. And there's a lot of legalities that govern how trials can be scheduled, so they may even have a problem seating juries. There was a trial yesterday in Fortuna that hasn't gotten much publicity at all yet, of an individual who non-cooperated in his arrest on September 15th.
We don't have time for this. Naomi, stop. We don't have time.
Okay, they could barely see a jury for that.
Okay, well, the one thing I wanted you to say, I'll just say it since you won't, is that you said that about 20% of the caseload is...
About 20% of the caseload of every day in court is being taken up by Headwaters protesters.
That's great. Thanks a whole lot for going to this hearing and calling in and being a news stringer for us and giving us this...
Your ears should be burning. This is a tribute to your work.
Well, and yours too. Thanks a whole lot.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, so that was Naomi Wagner reporting live from the trial of the Headwaters 71,033rds. And now, moving right along here, we have on the phone with us Sue Miller, who's going to be talking about the Caltrans stuff that's coming on with the sprain. Susan, are you there?
I am. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for coming on. We got here this very, very long fax from... concerning this, and it's from the Toxic Outcry Coalition, which I presume you're part of?
What is it called?
It says on here, Greg Krause, Toxic Outcry Coalition.
I don't know. I don't know what that is.
The newest name? okay, well, regardless of the rotating names, what's not rotating is the policies of Caltrans. It seems that on December 16th, they got another plan to come on through and start brain. So I guess what I want you to start is just fill us in a little bit on how we got here, and the fact that it was stopped, et cetera.
Okay. Apparently, this is something that a lot of people don't know. Caltrans has been kind of changing their plans around. Just a quick note. I started working on pesticides a couple of years ago when Jackson State Forest CDF wanted to spray quite a bit of acreage in the Casper Creek watershed, and we made them not do that. Then I was involved last year with state parks at Jug Handle Park. They had been spraying Garlon on the gorse every year for the last several years, and they stopped doing that. So now Caltrans had a short hiatus of spraying the highways from about 1989 through about 1993 while they were doing their EIR. And then they resumed again spraying Mendocino County and the rest of District 1, which includes Humboldt County, around 93 or 94.
So the hiatus, was that the voluntary moratorium that they talk about?
That is correct. They were forced into it. The Sierra Club threatened to sue them because they were working without any knowledge or information about what they were doing, applying all these pesticides all over. Caltrans is the largest user of pesticides in the state of California, so they were kind of running wild, so a lawsuit was threatened, and Caltrans agreed to do an EIR, which is kind of unfortunate because I think they were let off the hook too easily. The EIR, they bought and paid for it themselves and approved it themselves and are now working with a very flawed, ridiculous document.
And the EIRs actually in general tend to just give them an excuse to do what they shouldn't be doing rather than actually change anything.
So then they resumed spraying. And, you know, I was told by the Citizens Alternatives to Toxics up in Arcata that people have been trying to make Caltrans stop spraying poisons for 24 years.
Wow.
In this district. So now I figure Caltrans has been softened up and they're ready for the fall and the big push is on right now.
And if there's anyone can do it, it's Mendo County.
Well, yes. October 19th, we held a demonstration on Highway 1 between Mendocino and Fort Bragg. And we had about 45 people. We marched on the highway with signs protesting Caltrans' planned spraying of Highway 1. We then planned a large demonstration for Highway 1 on December 2nd, and right before that, Caltrans announced that they were postponing only for the month of December spraying of Highway 1 in Mendocino County.
Voluntarily again, of course.
Yes. However, they are continuing to spray every other state highway in the county. This is information that is actually new. They have been saying, you know, I've been on the phone a lot with Caltrans, and every time I talk to them, they have a different story. But they had been telling me that they were only going to spray a couple of selected highways in Mendocino County. Now it turns out they're spraying them all again. They just sprayed every state highway in Mendocino County at the end of April and the beginning of May this year. They're doing it again now. The half-life of some of the pesticides that they have sprayed, they're still active and out there, and then they are going to be adding more on top of that are already in the environment.
And then another issue, of course, is the water solubility of some of these pesticides. Why are they spraying these in the rainy season?
I just think that Caltrans is out of control.
Yeah, it sure sounds it.
I've spoken with water quality control in Santa Rosa, and they are appalled that Caltrans is spraying during our rainy season like this, because what happens is that they may apply the poison last week, but next week if we get rains, the poison is still there. It's going to wash the poisons into all the receiving waters, including the groundwater, the creeks, the ocean, etc.
I know they said something about they were going to try to keep it out of drainage areas, but at the side of the road is a drainage area. So
it's just not possible. So anyhow, they postponed the spraying of Highway 1 only for the month of December. They have a list on their recorded line whereby the week of December 2nd they're spraying Highway 101 and Highway 271. These are all in Mendocino County. The week of December 9th they're spraying Highway 162 out to Covelo. The week of December 16th they're spraying Highway 253 from Ukiah to Boonville. The week of December 23rd they're spraying Highway 128 from I guess the county line to the coast. And the week of December 30th, they're intending to spray Highway 20 from Willits to Fort Bragg. Now, so this is their plan of attack. This could vary. If it's actually storming right at the very moment, they may withhold their spraying. So that's why we are calling a demonstration on or about December 16th. And we're going to be assuming it's going to be on or about or around Highway 253 or 128. But people need to stay tuned to the radio and keep their ears open about exactly when it'll be. And the people can get updates also from the Mendocino Coast Environmental Center. We are planning a nonviolent training for this Thursday in Boonville with Pam Miller as the trainer. And more details will come on this as to the location and time on the radio. We're also planning a nonviolent training on the coast. And what we're doing now is to prepare for the next demonstration, which is going to be huge. We're undergoing a public campaign to foster more awareness and to make Caltrans stop. And this is why we're working on the radio, to let people know that, and I'm encouraging people to take steps now to prevent spraying in our communities. There's so many people that live close to the highways, so many people that are connected to the water that's connected to and crossed by many highways. So we are asking people to make more than one phone call. What we have to do, and what I think is successful, is to make a huge deal out of it. So we should be making a lot of calls. We should be calling, and I can give you a list, and I have phone numbers if you want.
Okay, well, actually, I do, but I want you to say the phone numbers for a minute, because we got a question. Somebody's calling in to ask a question about Caltrans. Just hold on a minute, okay? Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. It has been so long that I honestly don't remember the history, but it was my impression that we had stopped this under the leadership of Christy Sarconi from Comte.
I'm sorry, that's not the case.
The second point I want to make is that, particularly with Highway 128, the decision to make the last ag valley in Mendocino County into the road to Mendocino may be the stupid decision from all that follows as to roadside vegetation. It simply is nuts. There are vineyards down to the edge of the roads, vineyards and apples and everything else all along 128, from the redwoods all the way to the county line. And the pattern of settlement, of course, is such that there are people living right on Highway 128. My water well is maybe 30 feet from 128. And I wonder if you, being interested in workers, would like to talk about the changes in Caltrans staffing, where I understand from some of the workers now that people who used to be Caltrans employees looking forward to retirement are now kind of temps, you know, and have presumably the insecurity and lack of union power that goes along with that.
Well, I'm not aware. I would be in.
There's a lot of things not to spray 128, whatever they do.
Okay. Well, I hope we see you out there, Anna. Okay.
There's a lot of things that need to be looked into, and that would be one of them. I just haven't personally had the time because I've just kind of, been sticking my fingers in the holes in the dam here to stay one step ahead of Caltrans to prevent them from spraying anymore.
Well, you know, I wasn't aware of that either. I always thought that Caltrans was a union job. So if anybody has any information, we'd be happy to follow that up. But I think the thing about Christy Sarconi, let me go back for a minute. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sue, Christy Sarconi was one of the leaders of the anti-aerial spray campaign, but I didn't know, I think that Anna may have been incorrect. Is that right?
That's right. But unfortunately, it was so specific. It was specific to particular two particular chemicals, and it was only specific to aerial application.
And the state overruled it. But nonetheless, I think what's really interesting about that, though, is first of all, there was an alliance between loggers, hippies, anybody across the spectrum in this county that helped bring that about. And also that the fact that we had that much activism has intimidated the companies, even though they legally can do it. They don't aerial spray here to the extent that they do in Humboldt. So I think all this resistance really has a lot of hope.
But next time, let's not be so specific to the chemical or the method of application.
Oh,
and
totally.
This is one thing that I'm hoping that we can somehow bring this all together so that the work that people are doing isn't so site-specific. You know, there's the headwaters. There's, I understand, 170 people showed up at the Board of Supervisors about the Lockheed processing of nuclear fuel. And it seems to me if we were not so specific, you know, all the people that went to the supervisors, it should have counted for everything else. And I haven't run across one person that thinks that it's a good idea for Caltrans to spray poisons on the roads.
Well,
not a controversial problem.
No, and I really think that what's happening now is exactly what's needed, is focusing that energy and focusing it towards action, because the bureaucracy just allows them to keep spraying. So what I want to do, we're going to have to move on, unfortunately, so I want to ask you to not only give the phone numbers, but to repeat how people can hook up with the nonviolence training so that everybody can be ready for this. There will be, as I understand it, there'll be someone with a cell phone that'll be following the truck and will get the information out to you on the radio. I don't know the exact specifics. We'll be able to announce that in more detail next week. We'll still have one more of these shows before the truck arrives. So can you give that last information for us?
All I know about the nonviolent training planning is that it's going to be next Thursday in Boonville with Pam Miller. So people will have to just stay tuned for more details. I'd like to point out that for people to participate in this, they don't need any special knowledge about the science of toxicology. For people to write letters to editors, to make calls to Caltrans, to complain about this, to make a big deal out of it, all you need to know is that they're spraying poison and we don't want it. So don't be shy. So that's what we need people to do, is to just make a huge issue out of it, and they will have to simply just follow along.
Okay, well, so
I would like to give out a few numbers. Here's the message that they update every now and then that tells you what they're doing in Mendocino County. It may or may not be exactly specific to the day. It probably won't be, but it will be changing. And that number is in Eureka. It's 441-5834. To call Caltrans, the head of Caltrans is General James Van Loben Sells, and he's the director in Sacramento at 916-654-5267. And Rick Knapp is the district director in Eureka. His number is 445, same area code, 707, 445-6445.
Okay, and can you repeat the dates of the spraying one last time so everybody has it in their mind?
Yeah. Okay, so they've pretty much completed the spraying of Highway 101 from county line to county line, and also 273, which is up around Leggett. The week of December 9th, they are due to spray Highway 162 going out to from 101 to Covelo. The chemicals they're using is Roundup and Diaron. The week of December 16th, they're spraying Highway 253. The week of December 23rd, they're spraying Highway 128.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be talking about this more, and I think we will see the kind of response that we got to RETEC, because people really, you're right, this is a pretty much a unanimous thing. There's not very many people in this county that support this spraying. So thanks a whole lot for your work over the years and for sticking through it and helping us get this going again.
Thanks, Judy.
Okay. All right, that was Sue Miller, and we'll be following this toxic spray truck, probably literally as well as on the air. So anyway, but we have on the phone now our next guest as we're rolling right on through this show, and we have one of the Headwaters walkers, I believe. Is that right? Hello? Caller?
Hello?
Yes. Okay, yes, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. This is actually not a hiker just yet. He's right behind me.
Okay.
Just wanted to let you know that the in regards to the 162 spraying on the 9th, that a lot of citizens in Covelo have already gotten together and are planning an action out there on Monday.
Oh, that's great. Is this John?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad I didn't reach you, and I had heard rumors that there was something happening with the spraying in Covelo, so give us a detail on that.
No, I was on the phone yesterday to as many ranchers, business people. I have friends in the Indian community, and there's a incredibly broad-based support to stop what's going to happen on 162 in specific, and, you know, I agree, it is a county-wide, it's a statewide, you know, worldwide issue. And
okay.
So we need to focus on the whole thing, but specifically Monday, they're going to try and be out there on 162, and there's a incredible lot of support for and not having that happen. So
well, keep us up on that. I mean, some people might be willing to go over from Willits or Laytonville, so
well,
keep us up.
I've been trying to get a specific time and place where they will begin spraying, and it's like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
Nobody will return calls or let us know exactly what's happening. So we're going on the assumption that because Monday is the beginning of the spray day, that we'll be out there at Longvale, which is where we presume they're going to be. But that's all we can do right now is presume.
All right.
Unless
we'll
we
do
can get some more information on specifics. Which
we'll do an aerial recon.
It's hard.
Okay. Thanks a whole lot, John.
Okay. The Headwaters person is right behind me, so
okay.
We'll keep going. Hey, Judy. It's Carrot Top.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Okay. Are you drenched?
No, not today. Today, luckily, it didn't rain down too much.
Okay, so Carrot Top is one of the hikers who is hiking from Eureka to San Francisco. When did you leave?
We left on the 22nd, which was a couple Fridays ago, and we're still hiking hardcore every day, and
ooh,
even rain or shine, you know.
How many miles do you go in a day about?
We try to do at least 13. Sometimes it's been more, and sometimes it's been less. Like a couple days ago, it was really rainy, so we cut it short and had to make up for that yesterday. But we're on schedule right now, and right now there's a rally outside the Eureka Courthouse as we speak. The people are out there waving signs and playing drums and stuff. So
right,
feel
great.
Free to give a honk or something if you drive by and see them, or come and join us. You're all welcome.
Okay, but it's the Ukiah Courthouse.
Yep,
When you guys, you lose track of where you are. Well, what's it been like? Well, first of all, I heard that one person is hiking barefoot. Is this true?
Not that I've seen.
I'm so glad.
Some silly rumors come about like everything, and we like to wear shoes because the concrete really...
Yeah, I can't imagine walking barefoot on concrete. I'm glad to hear that one's not true. So what's it been like? Do you carry a banner when you walk down? How many of you are there? What does it look like when we see you on the road?
Well, weather depending, like we'll have the banner. And usually in urban areas, we'll carry the banner because we'll see more people. But like a lot of times on the busy highway, we can't carry the banner because of either A, the weather, or like B, the cars are going way too fast and it really like endangers the walk. To have to be blowing around with a banner like while they're carrying it, because we got a pretty big banner, and
uh-huh.
We're trying to get like more signs and stuff like that as we go.
Maybe if you had like skateboards or inline skates or something, use a banner for a sale. Probably cheating though. And how have people reacted? Do people try to run you off the road? Do they honk? Do they offer you rides?
Well, occasionally we have like the one bad apple of the bunch who like tries to run us over or something like that. Like comes dangerously close to the line on the side of the road just to scare us, and we all jump and stuff. But normally it's been like real good response, like at least a wave or most of the time, or like nothing at all when we wave to them.
And people are putting you up all the way along the road? You've organized all these places to stay and stuff?
Yeah, we got the Sonoma County Earth First people. They're working on finding us places to stay down in Sonoma. And also the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters is working for like the last leg of the journey, like the rallies and that, and places to stay along the way. And they're really helping us out, and we give a lot of thanks to them.
What are you planning?
Like, we couldn't have done it without them.
What are you planning on doing when you get to San Francisco?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
What are you planning on doing when you get to San Francisco?
Well, we got a lot of rallies along the way, and starting out the list a few, there's one on Tuesday, December 10th at high noon at the Santa Rosa Junior College, and there's going to be like speakers and music and stuff there. And also the next day, Wednesday, December 11th, there will be a rally at Sonoma State University on the main quad, and those are the two that are definitely planned out, high noon on those days. And then we got a rally in Fairfax, which is right outside San Rafael, and that's on the 14th. And people could call the hotline number to find out the date for that. And also the two main things we're doing is a mass crossing of the Golden Gate Bridge, and that's going to be Sunday, December 15th. We're all going to gather at the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge and walk across in San Francisco in like symbolic manner of the walk. And you can also call the hotline for the time for that.
Do you have that number?
We're going to be hiking in the morning.
Do you have that number?
The Hike for Headwaters voicemail hotline is 415-289-7000, extension 200. And you can also call Sonoma County Earth First, which is 707-523-1229, and the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters, which is 510-835-6303. And they can tell you, if you call like later, a little later, like maybe sometime next week, they can have the rally dates that are definite, and also the times that we'll be meeting there for the two main rallies.
Okay.
There's also the big rally in the end at Senator Feinstein's office in San Francisco, and that's on Monday, December 16th, and that's going to be the big one with like a bunch of bands, a bunch of speakers, and the hikers all coming in. That's going to be like the grand finale for like this whole march.
Okay, well, thanks a whole lot. We got to move on because we're behind on the time here. So thanks for doing this.
All right.
Quite an undertaking, and wish you luck along the way. Have fun at the rally, and tell everybody hi for me.
All right, thanks a lot, Judy.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
All right. Okay, so that was Kara Topp from the Headwaters Hikers. I am even getting out of breath on this show, and I am used to these pace. But anyway, here we go. Fast-paced show here. And the next person that we have on the line is Renee Gannon. Renee, are you there?
I am here. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Renee is from the Sunnel Neighborhood, Sunnel Neighborhood Action Group? Is that it?
Are you there?
Yeah.
Sunnel Neighborhood Awareness Group.
Awareness. Yeah, I knew I had something wrong there. And you know, Renee, you've been getting just profusive praise in our community for the way you've presented your case regarding ReTech and the kind of the organization that has gone into it. And I know they've been going over and over on this radio station. There's been a lot of coverage, a lot of credit to David Colfax for bringing this to the fore, a lot of credit to Richard Johnson. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your group and how this came to be. I actually heard on the radio from some caller that SNAG is composed of a bunch of rich people in million-dollar houses. Could you describe who you actually are?
I'd say we're pretty average, middle-income people. And these are not million-dollar homes by any stretch of the imagination. They're homes of working people who have cared very much about living outside the city, living in a rural environment to raise their children in healthy, clean air. And, you know, we're just regular people like you.
All right. Well, I don't know if I'm so regular.
Here, as far as I know, except the people down the road from us.
There you go.
ReTech.
And ReTech's corporate owners also, which is Lockheed.
Yes.
Okay, so this group now, of course, everybody knows, or most people know, and who listen to this show, I presume, about the explosion and the death that happened at the plant last April. Was there anything? Is that kind of the impetus that got you going, or was there anything happening before that? Were you already on to that something sneaky was going on in this factory?
We have been getting together and talking and trying to get the county to listen to us since the fall of '94. When ReTech first requested a zoning change to be allowed to build 65-foot high buildings. And people here in the neighborhood were concerned about that, and we started getting together, and we filed complaints and comments with various county departments. We met with Charles Peterson a little later than that, and we basically got nowhere. And we kept meeting and talking and just being concerned about what's happening down there. Our feeling is, I hate to say it, that it probably never belonged there in the first place. And as it's been growing and changing, it's gotten way out of hand. And the county isn't regulating what's happening at ReTech at all because they hire a lot of people.
And actually, that's one of the really interesting aspects to me of this, is that instead of saying, well, okay, EPA or OSHA or somebody should be regulating this from the federal government or from out of town, your orientation, I believe, from the beginning has been that this is the county's responsibility.
It is the county's responsibility, and when we have checked with state and federal agencies, we have been told, again, it is the county's responsibility, and we need to focus in on the county, and that's what we're doing.
All right. And now the 170 people at the Board of Supervisors meeting is very impressive. I wasn't there myself. I read that most of them were from your group. Do you agree with that statement?
I'd say at least half or more were from our group, probably more than half. I don't know how many exactly. I was sitting up at the front and focusing very strongly on what we needed to say. That day was our chance to put together everything that we have been working on for the past 2 years.
And did you have any prior organizing experience before this? I know you have some theater experience.
No, I'm a registered nurse by training and a theatrical costume design also by training. My experience is as a human in this earth and as a mother, and I feel very strongly as a mother about the air my children are breathing and what they're living in.
Yeah, well, it definitely, that seems to be the best motivation, because really people have just very much gotten aware of this. That what happened at the Board of Soups meeting in the presentation that you all did was, rather than just getting up and ranting, believe me, I'm not trying to criticize getting up and ranting, it's certainly needed, but that you all really totally had together all of your facts and the violations and the kind of things. And some of the specifics of it involved both when OSHA went in and inspected after the accident, just horrendous violations, and then also some of the zoning things that weren't done. Can you describe some of those?
Some of the zoning violations? Well, you know, one thing that's really interesting is that Retech lies on land that has been zoned light industrial, I-1. There are two types of industrial zoning, I-1 and I-2. I-1 is light, limited industrial, I-2 is general industrial. And in the beginning of 1995, after Retech requested to be rezoned to I-2, the owner of the property, Max Schlinger, who was at that point the owner of Retech as well, signed a contract with the Board of Supervisors requiring that although he was being given I-2 zoning, it was only so that he could build 65-foot buildings, that all other uses of the property must be limited to I-1 zoning uses. And our contention is that Retech is not functioning as an I-1 facility at all. Some of the other violations that have been Judy, there are hundreds of violations over the course of time. The latest one we had has some 84 violations. Manufacturing chemical powders, magnetic powders in substandard buildings for that use. Manufacturing chemical powders without permits whatsoever. In the Magna Quench operation, Cal OSHA assessed over $32,000 in fines to them, which is to us a lot of money. To them, it's a drop in the bucket. However, those fines were assessed because of the seriousness of the violations. They had a couple of 100,000 pounds of Magna Quench crushed ribbon, which is this iron neodymium boron powder, right near the furnace.
It's incredible
what they get away with. It's really just amazing to me.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered what was going on in that building. It kind of always seemed like it should have a sign outside that says, better you don't know.
Really?
And what they're doing certainly seems to be incompatible with have residential uses or actually any human uses to do. But one of the things that's interesting to me is the shift of this from local ownership to out-of-town corporate ownership. And when you say that agreements were made with the county, well, those agreements were made before the shift in ownership?
The agreement was made before the shift in ownership, to the best of my knowledge. I believe that it was mid-March of 95 that Lockheed bought Retech at the same time that it merged with Martin Marietta, forming Lockheed Martin. And the contract was signed on March 3rd of 95. The contract goes with the land. Max Schlinger sold his business, the patents and whatever the business entailed, but he did not sell the property or the buildings. He still owns the land, and that contract stipulates that it goes with the land forever.
And this was actually, I think this is what Liz Henry was saying, that she felt that she had been duped. Is that?
Mm-hmm. I think she's right.
It sure sounds like all of us have. I think I cut you off. I think we got a little bit more time to get into this. So was some of the, we talked about the zoning violations. There was also just a horrendous slew of OSHA violations that were discovered. Have they been corrected, or they said, okay, well, we're not going to process these hazardous materials until the hearing on December 16th. How is that monitored? Does anybody actually know what's going on in there now?
I have no idea. It's hard to tell. My understanding from that was that they simply said that they had no test firings, no processing, in line. They weren't intending to do any during that time period, so it was very easy for them to agree not to do any during that time period.
Wow, very generous of them.
These furnaces they make are huge, and I don't think they make many per year. And they make one, they put it all together, and then they test fire it, apparently. So there is time in between. That's not their only job. They also, you know, make all these other furnaces. It's hard for me to really explain. It's hard for me to understand what it is they really do down there. But they sure as heck just aren't making little metal ovens. In terms of the Cal-OSHA violations, the Cal-OSHA violations specifically related to the hazards to the employees who were injured. And it was explained to me very clearly by a safety engineer at Cal-OSHA that those violations were all abated right away simply because the employees involved were no longer in that situation. Well, as we know, Ed Hensley was no longer involved in that situation because he was busy dying in a hospital as a result of those injuries, as a result of those violations.
Wow. Okay, hold on. We got a call, so 1 second. Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Chuck, and I actually work at Retech, and I was calling. I was just listening to your station, and I was wanting to get that lady's name and number that you were just talking to about Retech.
She's still on the air, so you can talk to each other.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Chuck Sitnick, and I worked at Retech back in assembly and was exposed to something that gave me this weird rash, and they're refusing to give me a list of the materials that I was exposed to while I was working there.
What do you want, the materials that are in MagnaQuench?
In fact, what I was working on was covering up the old R&D pit that was, and I worked in assembly, and what happened is where I was working was actually what was to become the MagnaQuench area at the time of my mishap. I would show up for work and show my foreman that there was nothing wrong with me, and after being there for an hour or so, I'd break out in like this weird rash, and I was wanting to find out what I was exposed to. So I could determine whether it was something that I would want to deal with. And what they did is they sent me to a doctor and put me on prednisone, which is a steroid, to block the reaction that my body would have. And
rather than removing you from the toxic chemicals that were causing the reaction.
Yeah, exactly. And they wouldn't tell me. I have the services of an attorney now, and they won't even tell him what I was exposed to. And I don't know, so if they can tell what they were. Because some of the furnaces that we were testing, for instance, there was one that we were building for Knowles Atomic Lab, and they can tell you what goes in it, but after it's heated up to ungodly amounts of degrees, what is it then? And I don't think they could tell me. And I think that they were in a little bit over their head. I don't know.
Renee, do you want to give him a way to get in touch with you? Should we have him call the radio after the show?
I think probably that would be best, if he would call the radio after the show, because I don't really feel comfortable giving my name and number over the radio.
Okay.
I understand.
But yes, I would be happy to speak with you more. And
actually, if you would like, my attorney's Eric Peterson, and my name is Chuck Sitnick, if you would even like to call him.
Okay, Chuck, let me ask you to call back and ask for me, Judy Barry, after the show.
All right.
Call at, you can call at 895-2448. This show ends at 1:30.
Okay.
Thanks a whole lot for calling in.
No problem.
It's really the kind of stuff we got to get to the bottom of.
Yep.
Okay.
Bye now.
Thank you. Okay. I hope I pushed the right button here. I did. Okay. I didn't remember which line each of you was on, so that could have been
a
disaster. You know, we got another call. I'm sorry. I'm not going to take it because we're really running too close on the time. I wish we could. I'll spend more time on this next week because we will be coming up on this hearing on the 16th. What I guess I want to ask you to do is tell us what your, Renee, is tell us what your future plans are. Are you preparing a lawsuit? Are you waiting and seeing how the county reacts? What are your plans?
We addressed a list of demands to the county, and we have a meeting with them on December 16th. And we're going to go back and hear what the county has to say and hear what Retech has to say, and we'll move from there.
Can you just briefly say what some of the demands are?
We demand that various department heads do their jobs to protect the public, and if they do not, we demand that the county find others who will. Those department heads are Mike Scannell, Ray Hall, Carol Mordhorst, John Rogers, David Faulkner, and Susan Messini. Do you want me to read the demands?
Yeah, could you?
We demand that the Board of Supervisors request that District Attorney Susan Massini file criminal charges against Retech M4 and MagnaQuench International in the death of Ed Hensley. We demand that Planning and Building Services issue a cease and desist order on incinerator testing and operations at Retech M4 and require an environmental impact report, including a traffic study, before considering issuance of use permits. We further demand that Planning and Building Services enforce the I-1 zoning restriction on Retech operations as mandated by contract. We demand that the Division of Environmental Health conduct an independent audit of any and all toxic and nuclear materials at Retech M4 and issue a cease and desist order if those materials are not being stored and handled in accordance with state and federal regulations. We demand that the Air Quality Management District inspect all present and potential air emissions at Retech M4. And take action if additional permits and environmental review is necessary. We demand that the public health officer conduct an independent inspection of all Retech M4 operations and assess the health risks to workers and the public. We demand that the county call in the State Department of Toxic Substances Control to conduct an independent inspection and investigation of all operations at Retech M4. We demand that each of these departments issue a public report within 30 days and that the Board of Supervisors schedule a public hearing to review these reports immediately following completion. We demand safety and compliance now.
Okay, that's great. Okay, well, I can see we have a lot of interest in this because the phones keep ringing, but I'm really going to have to move on. Sorry, everybody. And we'll come back to this because, you know, I think a lot of people have a lot to say on it, and maybe we can talk to you again, Renee.
Well, thank you very much, Judy. It's been a pleasure, and it's definitely been a group effort. There was a lot of research, a lot of work, a lot of organization, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be heard.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks. Okay, that was Renee Gannon from SNAG, Sunnel Neighborhood Awareness Group, and we'll be talking about Retech again next week, and I think a lot of other shows will be too. So people who I didn't get to your questions or comments, I'm sorry, but I am going to have to move on here. What I'm going to do right now, I'm going to be placing a call to Timothy Pratt, who is Geronimo Pratt's brother. And while I'm placing that call, I'm going to put on some music, but not just any old music, because tonight, December 6th, at Ukiah High Cafetorium, at Ukiah High, and in Ukiah, there's going to be a concert, and it's a benefit for Lyme's disease. There's going to be speakers, and there's going to be singers. And the singer, the lead singer here, is Jim Page. And for those of you who don't remember who Jim Page is and might not be planning to go to this concert because you don't remember who he is, I'm going to remind you who he is. He is the person who wrote and performed the beautiful song called Anna May, about Anna May Aquash, that I played on this show before to rave reviews. So I'm going to play this song again, and if people can get out to Ukiah to this benefit tonight, you can actually hear it live. It's just a really beautiful song, and here, so we'll do that, and then we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Trouble in the Pine Ridge settlement grew with the cold, the cold wind below. And in 1873, blow the cold to blow. The trouble exploded a wounded knee with the cold wind below. And in 1874, blow the cold to blow. There was a backlash beating at everybody's door, and the cold wind they blow. And then the warning passed from tongue to tongue, blow the cold to blow, that there was trouble coming with the federal gun, and the cold wind they blow.
Okay, that was Jim Page singing Anna May, and Jim Page will be performing in Ukiah tonight at 8 o'clock p.m. at Ukiah High Cafetorium, so make it on down there and you can hear not only that song but his other great songs. And while that song was going, we got a call telling us that the Pomo Tribe will be doing a dance Yokayo Pomo Dancers will be performing at College of the Redwoods in Fort Bragg on December 8th at 11 a.m. So anybody wants to get on over and hear that, that's happening in Fort Bragg. I have on the phone with me now, or at least I will in a minute, somebody I'm actually quite honored to have on this show. I have Timothy Pratt, who is the brother of Geronimo Pratt. Geronimo, as I'm sure most of you know, is one of the most long-standing political prisoners in the United States. He was framed in 1971 for a murder that he very definitely didn't commit. He was framed by the FBI. In fact, one of the agents who was directly involved, one of the three agents directly involved in the framing, was Richard Held himself, the very man who's in charge of my case. So I feel a strong connection to this for other reasons. But also on November 22nd, when I was down in Oakland for a hearing on my own lawsuit against the FBI, there was also a court hearing taking place in Geronimo's case down in Los Angeles, where they are trying to get this case reopened after all these years to have a rehearing and see if we can, because the evidence that's come in since the trial has clearly shown this to have been a frame-up. So I'll see if we got Timothy. You're on the air. Can I hear you now? Hello.
Yes.
Ah, good. Okay, you are there. Okay. So what I wanted to start. Are you Geronimo's older brother or younger brother?
I'm his younger brother.
Okay. I wanted to start by asking you to just kind of describe what kind of family you come from. Where do you come from, and you know what kind of upbringing Geronimo?
We were born and raised in Morgan City, Louisiana, which is on the Gulf of Mexico, in the boot of the state. We're between New Orleans to our east and Houston, Texas on our west, and we're about 50 miles from the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, and did you come from a large family?
There were seven children in our family. Geronimo was the youngest, and we were about maybe 18 months apart.
Okay, and now Geronimo, I guess he must have been in his 20s or so when he went to Los Angeles, is that right?
That's right. He had just been discharged from the Army and decided to go to Los Angeles and attend college. And he was approximately maybe 20, going on 21 at the time.
Well, Geronimo really distinguished himself in the Black Panther Party as a leader, and of course was targeted by the FBI for that. Some of the things, I know one of the incidences that he really stood out in was the assault on the Black Panther office in Los Angeles. I think it was the first time they actually used the name SWAT team, Special Weapons and Tactics, of the LAPD coming in and surrounding that office, and people managed to get out of there with no bloodshed. Can you describe that?
Yes, that was one of G's. I think G was very proud of that. One of the things that had happened to the Black Panther Party was that the FBI was very bold, and they began to break into the offices and just shoot people. I know that you're familiar with Fred Hampton and Clark out in Chicago. And in other parts of the country, the FBI just decided to break down doors and shoot people. Well, Geronimo, having been in Vietnam and being a very skilled soldier, decided to fortify the LH chapter of the Panther Party. It was almost like a bunker. And when the police stormed the building, they couldn't get in. I think they seized it for about, they lay siege on it for about maybe three or four days. And they were unable to penetrate the building.
And people were holed up inside the whole time?
Yes. They had even dug trenches underneath the building and what have you. Somebody was shot and they simply took care of their own wound.
Well, wow, so this is really the FBI's worst nightmare, is a black revolutionary trained in the Vietnam War and using his skills for the people instead of for the oppressive government. And now the COINTELPRO program, which was quite opened at the time, what J. Edgar Hoover described it as, is a program to expose, misdirect, isolate, and neutralize various whoever that they would choose, dissidents. And Geronimo, of course, was specifically singled out to be neutralized.
That's right. A lot of the Panthers talked about, well, all of the Panthers talked about revolution. There were some Panthers who had some military background, but I don't think any of them were as experienced as G was, and certainly they were not as successful in stopping an attack on them by the FBI. And it was at that point that the FBI decided to make him their number one target.
And now some of the techniques, and this goes back to Richard Held, my own nemesis in the FBI, some of the specific techniques of COINTELPRO is infiltration and provocateurs, the use of fake documents to foment infighting and framing and assassinating leaders, and some of the famous cartoons in the Black Panthers that were sent back and forth. I have seen one with this little naked Geronimo pleading on a sword held by a big bad Karenga of U.S., a Black National group in the L.A. area. Can you tell about the kind of disinformation and the effect it had on the leadership?
Well, unfortunately, there was a lot of paranoia at the time because the FBI was coming in, shooting people, blaming it on other groups. They had they would come in with money, and there were a lot of people involved in the movement, unfortunately, who were easily motivated by money. And so Ron Karenga's group, the United Slaves, US organization, was responsible for the assassination or the murder of Bunchy Carter, one of the G's immediate predecessor as defense minister of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party. And as a after that murder took place, there began other assaults between the Black Panthers and Ron Karenga's group on each other. So it got to the point where the Panthers and the US members were more afraid of each other than they were of the LAPD or the FBI.
And of course the FBI was fomenting the whole thing. Well, now the murder for which Geronimo was framed, I think took place, was it in 1968?
Yes.
But he wasn't actually convicted of this or framed for it until 1971. Will you describe how that happened?
Well, one of the tactics that the FBI used, and they're still using today, is to arrest people and put them in jail. Because, you know, in this country, even though you're supposed to be assumed innocent until proven guilty, unfortunately, they can throw you in jail and set high bail on you. And if you don't have the means to pay that, well, then you have to stay in jail. And one of the so that was the tactic that they used to try to slow down the momentum of the movement. I think just about all the Black leaders, I don't care which ideology they represented, was eventually at one time or another thrown in jail and for long periods of time, including Martin Luther King himself. So they would throw you in jail, cause you to exert a lot of energy to raise money to get bail, and then eventually to hire an attorney. So G was charged with about maybe six or seven different murders prior to this one sticking. Most of them, when he got to court, were just thrown out because they were so obviously frame-ups.
So then how did they manage to make this one stick?
I think it surprised them. I don't think that they expected him to be convicted. I think they were really surprised. And I think what happened was the judge in this case was very favorable for the prosecution. And the jurors actually took about 2 weeks in which to come up with the verdict. Every time they would come back saying we're deadlocked, the judge would tell them to go back and come up with a decision.
So now the crime that they were charging him with was killing a white woman on a tennis court in Santa Monica over an $18 robbery. The husband of the woman who was killed was also shot. And I know that at one point he came forward and testified that Geronimo was the person who shot his wife. I know that there was a witness named Julius Butler who turned out to work for the FBI. What were the things that they used to convince the jury of this?
Well, what they did initially was to put Julius Butler on. Julius Butler was a police informant, an FBI informant, who denied on the stand that he worked for the FBI. He claimed later that what happened was he gave the he gave a police sergeant in L.A. a letter in which he alleges that G confessed the murders to him, and that the police officer should not open that letter unless something happened to Judy or Butler. And the police officer has since testified that there was an FBI agent who was standing right there when Butler gave him the letter. So it was obvious that this was something that was conjured up by the FBI and Julio Butler. And so even though Julio Butler never said that he witnessed the murder, he said simply said that Geronimo told him this.
Okay, and now I have a statement from one of the jurors. And one of the jurors who followed all this and was led into believing it, and this is a juror named Jean Hamilton. She said, "It makes me want to cry. I know now that Pratt is a man who is principled and intelligent and innocent. I've destroyed his life, though I feel I was a victim too. I was 22 years old. The government had a lot of credibility. They betrayed us. We did not have the whole story. It's amazing to me that they won't give this man a hearing now. It's a crime. We would never have convicted him if we knew what we know now." So now Geronimo, nonetheless, was sent to jail. It was for 20 years, right?
Well, no, it was for life, but it was 20 years to life.
Oh, okay, that's okay. And the first, I don't know how many of them, were spent in solitary confinement?
Yes, the first 8 years of his life was spent in solitary confinement with no rational basis for doing that, no legal basis for doing that. And when we finally won that case, won a suit against the penal authorities to have him released onto the general population, what the judge did was to award G $1.
$1 damages?
We were happy to get him out, but to then to turn around and insult him by awarding him $1 damages just demonstrated the amount of contempt that they had for this guy, for my brother.
Absolutely. So over the years, have you been able to visit him and see him and keep in touch with him?
Well, yes. I would visit him probably twice a year up until recently because I'm on the East Coast. I'm in Washington, D.C., so it's pretty expensive to travel back and forth. So I last saw him 2 years ago.
How does he hold up under this? I actually saw a video of him in jail, and his spirit seemed incredible. It's hard to imagine somebody putting up with such a long injustice and being in solidarity and being treated like that. What's he like?
G has always been a very strong person, a person who has a very optimistic person, a person who believes in people. And a person who believes that ultimately right will conquer. And it's amazing. I don't think I could have withstood what he has undergone. I really don't. But he's been that way ever since he was a child. He just has this tremendous love for people. If you ever meet him, you would just come away feeling that you've been in the presence of a good person. And I think that is what has sustained him. In addition to the prayers of my family, particularly my mother, over these years.
Well, that certainly showed through just even in seeing a video of him. So now, as he sat in jail for years and years, there has been an attempt to get a retrial and to bring some of this new evidence, which we'll talk about in a minute. But the efforts, can you talk about the efforts to get him a new trial? I think a lot of it had to do with the work of Reverend Jim McCloskey.
Well, prior to Reverend McCloskey, I should say Jim McCloskey, he's the director of Centennial Ministries, and because of that, we have a tendency to call him Reverend.
Oh, but he isn't really.
No, he has a degree in theology, but he's not a minister, so he prefers to be called Jim. But anyway, before he came on board, which was approximately 3 years ago, we knew that Julia Butler was a police informant. We knew that the defense team of G's first attorney, Johnny Cochran, had been infiltrated by the FBI. We knew that they actually planted an informant in G's defense team. And so when we brought those issues to court to get him a new trial, Judge Parker ruled that In the United States, we don't guarantee a person a perfect trial. And so she acknowledged the fact that Cochran's defense, G's defense team, had been infiltrated by an informant. In essence, she said, well, so what? We don't promise you a perfect trial in this country.
Well, I thought they promised us supposedly a fair trial. That hardly seems fair.
Yeah, and that's what she said. We promise you a fair trial, but not a perfect trial. Now, how that can be fair, I don't know. But that's what she did. And there were other efforts on our part before McCloskey came on board. But when McCloskey came on board, what he did was able to identify the composites that were initially given by the victim's husband, who doesn't, that don't even come close to representing Geronimo, but they fit perfectly the descriptions of two guys who are now deceased, but who had bragged about this murder to other people who have since come forward and admitted that these guys told them that they had committed these murders.
So I know that's some of the new evidence. I know some of the other evidence, some has to do with the fact that Geronimo was nowhere near Santa Monica.
He was at a Black Panther POW meeting in San Francisco, and the FBI knew that because they had tabs on every Panther member. When we sought that information, the FBI simply claimed that they could no longer find it. It had mysteriously disappeared. Now, we've had three FBI agents who have testified that in their experience, which totaled over 100 years, they had never known such valuable piece of information to just disappear.
I don't know. I've seen a lot of information disappear. In my case, I think it's pretty regular for the FBI to disappear information.
But no, I guess what I'm saying was that the FBI may lie and tell people that they don't have it, but in reality they do.
Ah, that's absolutely
true. That's the point, that the FBI just don't go around losing information.
Yes.
They may tell you they don't have it, but they do. And what these FBI agents, who are now former agents, were saying was that during their history at the FBI, they had never known a piece of information to get lost. Now, they may tell somebody that it's lost, but in reality, they knew where it was.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we're almost out of time, so I want to talk about what's going on with the new efforts to open up the trial. There's been a recent court hearing and some good-sounding decisions. Will you describe that?
Yes. Again, this information is not necessarily new, but what is new is that at least we had a judge who looked at the evidence and felt that the evidence was credible, the new evidence, which they call new. And this is primarily the evidence that was brought forth by Jim McCloskey's group, in which he points out the names of these guys who supposedly committed this murder, the fact that Geronimo was nowhere near, the fact that Julio Butler was indeed a police informant, and will now admit to the fact that he's a police informant, or at least the FBI will admit to the fact, that fact.
And I think the
FBI, nor the LAPD, had never been willing to do that before, but we think that now we have enough evidence where they would not be able to deny that, nor would Julio Butler.
And I think the district attorney, who also claimed not to know about his informant status, has now been exposed for having known it all along.
Yes, the district attorney, who at that time was a district attorney but is presently a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge, actually was complicit with the FBI in denying G a fair trial, or involved in a conspiracy to send an innocent man to jail for the rest of his life.
One of the interesting things in this latest round of attempts to get a new trial is that the entire bench, all of the judges in the Superior Court in Los Angeles, disqualified themselves because of the involvement of this district attorney, and it was sent to Orange County, which sounds dismal, but I want to take 1 minute to read a quote from the judge, Judge Dickey, that sounded pretty hopeful to me. Speaking of Bowles being the district attorney who pretended that he didn't know that Julio Butler was an informant when he did, he said, "I think we have to hear from Bowles. Just saying I don't remember how Butler's name turned up in the informant file is not good enough." The judge wondered why it's only being disclosed now, 24 years later, that Butler's name was in the informant file. "It's clear that this is not a typical case," Dickey said. "It cries out for resolution."
Yes, and it's, and again, this is really not recent. We've been saying this. I met Julio Butler years ago, and the first time I saw him, I knew he was a police informant. Those of us who were involved in a struggle, you can pinpoint people, and you knew who they were.
We know. We have the same thing here.
Right.
So can you tell us when, now the hearing that's coming up in Orange County is going to be a hearing to decide whether there'll be a reopening of the case?
Well, this is an evidentiary hearing. There will be, the purpose of it would be to determine whether or not there is enough evidence to reopen the case. And if there is such, then the judge and the prosecution at that point has to decide whether or not to reopen it.
And so when is this hearing?
The hearing is on December 16th.
Okay, that's coming right up. I know that Equal Justice USA, a group who does political prisoner work in the Bay Area, is planning on going to this hearing. So even though this is Southern California, if there's anybody up here who's interested in going, we can certainly hook you up with carpools, because I think it's very important that people show up.
Yeah, we're asking everybody who can possibly be there to please be there. If you're interested in justice being done, and an innocent man who has served almost 27 years in prison being given his freedom, and I should say that he just became a grandfather. His daughter just had a baby day before yesterday. Please make every effort to be there. Call your friends and relatives who are in Southern California or who can make it to Orange County, and please be there, because you really need your support.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on. We're out of time, so thanks for alerting us to this and letting us know some of the background. And if people would like to go and want to find out how to get rides, you can call the Mendocino Environmental Center at 468-1660. So thank you very much, Timothy Pratt.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, and this has been the Punch and Judy Show, and you're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo and KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah. So see you next week and stay tuned.